You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.
There is, if you listen closely enough, a slightly nervous shimmer to my voice on The Dan Nichols Show this week. Now, normally I'm completely comfortable with celebrities of all walks of life from all over the world. We've had some of the biggest names in global entertainment on this show, from Kurt Darren to, well, that's kind of where it ends. But today, I've got somebody who I think, and we're going to get the revelation on the show, I think is actually the person behind the majority of South African organised crime, because nobody can know as much as she does and still be with us unless this is her actual role. She's a journalist extraordinaire. She's one of my favourite authors. She is a fearless exposer of the truth and a very, very entertaining person to have two or three dozen beers with. It gives me great pleasure. Say hello to Mandy Wiener.
Dan Nichols, what an introduction.
I do know
a lot about organised crime.
Well, I was going to say this because one of the sad realities of this absolutely beautiful but utterly bipolar country that we call home is that people who pop up in opposition to the wrong side of the law do tend to come to a rather unfortunate end quite quickly. And you are somebody who has exposed so much, spoken about so much, told so many stories that lots of people would prefer you not to have, that my only conclusion can be that the reason you're still alive is you're actually pulling all the strings and running everything behind the scenes.
I'm like one of those mafia moms, right, that runs the cartel but actually gets everyone to do everything for them, to just carry out all the hits, like Animal Kingdom, if you've watched that. So, yeah, that's it. I'm actually the cartel boss. I'm running the South African underworld, and everything that happens, the pala-pala money, that was me, you know, every targeted assassination.
For years, people will be wondering why on the eve of the Mandy Wiener show, the Dan Nichols show came to a sudden end and nobody has heard from him in weeks and weeks and weeks. I do want to come into this space because it's an absolutely fascinating one. But the rewind for me is even more fascinating when we chart the story of how people find where they are today. I'm not sure if little Mandy Wiener running around the school grounds at the age of 7 or 8 was telling all her friends, one day I'm going to be an amazing investigative journalist. But whether you did or didn't, it was no doubt in your DNA because it's very much the person that you are. What was the path into finding your way into the media and then more specifically into being this fearless person you are today?
Literally as you just described it. When I was 7 or 8, was running around telling people I was going to be a journalist. Yeah.
That's
the truth. You knew it. I always knew I was going to be a journalist. I thought I was going to be a war reporter. I thought I was going to be a war correspondent. But from a very early age, I was a voracious reader. I used to follow the news. I would follow the TRC hearings as a kid. I was a ball of fun to be around, as you can imagine. But I used to watch the news. I'd always read the newspapers. I recently was going through a box of memorabilia and a whole lot of things that I'd kept from school. And every school project I'd done had been on journalism. So I had little magazines that I'd made, and so I kind of always knew. But you'll be interested to know that I also was super keen on being a cricket commentator. It's my big dark secret is that I'm a very good cricketer.
Why? I think this could still be your future.
This would be an amazing dream to be a cricket commentator.
I'm imagining you as a kid where the rest of your class are knocking a football around or talking about getting hold of the new Barbie, and you're discussing the Balkan crisis and how that might impact on European currencies. Was little Mandy Wiener... was it always that was just you, that was the nature of you? You were this high-powered nerd making your way through your school years.
Yeah, basically. But I was very sporty, so at least I counted it with that. So I played a lot of sports. And then I thought I was going to be a sports reporter, cricket commentator. I mean, I laugh. Like, I remember Christian Amanpour reporting on the Balkan crisis and watching it on CNN and being fascinated by it. So, you've got it. You nailed it.
Sport meets news. You could have gone for either. I think you would have been a fabulous cricket commentator, but quite glad that you did go into where you are because you've given so much for so much joy and interest over the years. What was the breakthrough? What was the first translation of schoolgirl dream into, oh, hang on, I've actually now got a foot in the door?
So I was on RAL Radio. student radio, where a lot of us started. And I was sitting around and somebody came into the newsroom and started speaking about the fact that there was an opening at 7:02 for a traffic writer. So I'd overheard this conversation. And I thought, I want to get in on that action, and made myself available and went for an interview. And I started off writing traffic on 7:02. It's the same place Leanne Manner started. It's the same place plenty of other people started as well. So I would go in early in the mornings and write the traffic bulletins for Harry Sideropoulos on 947. And he thought my name was something completely different for the first 6 months that I worked with him. He used to call me by the wrong name. And then I started call screening overnights. I produced Doki Dokrat's sports show on a Saturday afternoon.
Which I used to appear on.
You used to appear on. I used to have to phone you up and line you up for interviews.
And pretend to know something about football.
But my big break came when I was desperate for a job as a reporter. And I begged Katie Katapodis to send me out on a story. And she agreed that I could go and interview residents in Houghton, around the corner from Nelson Mandela's house, about water cuts in the neighborhood. And there I was, you know, what could possibly go wrong? And I was outside a beautiful home, and two guys pulled up next to me, jumped out the car and held me at gunpoint. And I had a 702 microphone. And I was holding it, and suddenly one of the men said to me, "Are you a reporter?" And I said, "Yes, I work for 702. And for some reason, I hit record on my recorder. So I recorded this whole thing. And he said, "I'm so sorry." And he gave me my car keys and my phone back and said, "We're looking for somebody else." And off they went. And I had the whole recording. And the next day I was on John Robbie's show on the front page of the Star.
So it wasn't just a random mugging or attack. They were after somebody in particular and they'd got the wrong person.
No, they just wanted to hijack the car that was next to me. But when they realised I was a reporter, that they realised they shouldn't have been hijacking me.
I think it's because they realised, oh, hang on, this is actually the boss in waiting of our greater cartel. So for most people, that would have been months and months of therapy after that encounter. Your response is, well, we'll jump onto John Robbie's show. We're on the front page of the paper. And I'm guessing that
Katie gave me a job.
Surge of adrenaline. This is what I want to do.
Absolutely. And I always say that I think it's something ingrained. Like, I think it's something inherent if you want to be a reporter. I've seen so many interns come into the newsroom who go out on a story and are thrown into a riot or a crime scene and go pale and find a bucket and realize that they can't do this. And it's just not for everyone. You know, there are lots of different kinds of journalism. My mother wishes that I wrote for a travel magazine or did cosmetic reviews. But
crochet column in Women's Weekly.
Precisely. But I do think it's a kind of calling, you know, in the way that teaching is or whatever it may be. I do think it's something that I just, because it is the adrenaline, they equate journalism with, what are they called? Paramedics and police officers. So it's the same kind of therapy required for journalists, but you're going towards the action when people are running away from it.
Yeah, it is. That's something's going wrong. Everyone else is hiding. Let's send you to the front line. And you've had many, many of those encounters. You got off to a fairly colourful start with the one you've just described. What are one or two of those others where even the absolutely fearless Mandy Wiener thought, you know what, maybe I've bitten off a little more than I can chew this time around?
I have this vivid memory of being in the basement of the Noord Street taxi rank with a shootout happening around me and me hiding, you know, "Mom, I'm fine." You know, my mom always had this theory that as long as she could hear me on the radio, she knew I was fine. But I was like, oh, I need to get closer so I can record the sound of the shooting much better. And I was like, oh, there's bullets whizzing around. I'm not sure that I'm in the right place here. So that was one. The story I think that perhaps has stayed with me for the longest in my career is a story that I won the CNN African Radio Journalist of the Year Award for. Just drop that in there. But it was the shooting of Kensani Mateleni, who was a two-year-old girl who was strapped to her mother's back. And they were walking on Bree Street, and there was a cash and transit heist that took place, a shootout. And a bullet struck Kensani while she was strapped to her mother's back. And I got there very, very quickly. The call came through to the newsroom and I immediately stuck my hand up and said I wanted to go. And I raced to Bree Street. And I got there as the paramedics were still working on people who had been shot. And I think that's probably the story that has stayed with me the most emotionally. You know, where I was almost, you know, witness to this happening. So such a devastating story. And I stayed on it for a long time. After that, I stayed on the police investigation into the people who were responsible for the shooting and what happened to the mother afterwards. And these stories stay with you for your career.
As they must, because you are a human being at the core of it. But it must be a constant struggle where you're often reporting on stories from a very intimate perspective that are not much fun to tell. And yes, they're the stories that get people gripped and listening. But if I'm listening, I can listen to it, park it and move on. When you're creating that story, when you're telling that story, the ghosts of many of those must linger with you.
I'm a big believer in therapy and mental health of reporters. It's something that's become a lot more prevalent today. You know, 20 years ago, when I was running around crime scenes, we still had that kind of gung-ho, hardcore, you know, we'll just tough it out kind of approach to it. And I've always been a big advocate for therapy for reporters. And we're seeing that become a lot more common in newsrooms now, where the mental health of reporters is being prioritized. And you don't need to be quite as tough, especially when you're a female. You know, when you're out with all the photographers and you're at a riot and a protest, you want to, you know, fit in and be a tough girl. But I think it's really important to keep in mind, obviously, that it's the secondary trauma. So you're not only on the scene of what happens, but then you speak about it for the rest of the day. And you're constantly regurgitating the details over and over. And you're also interviewing the people who are victims or people who are in mourning. And you find that they're able to talk to you because you're an external party. So there's a lot of different layers of trauma that you deal with.
I think there's that old school image of, well, at the end of a tough day of war reporting or crime reporting, the therapy is a bottle of whiskey in a slightly dingy bar and you're up the next morning and that's how you deal with it. And that secondary trauma that you speak of, A, that's not going to be the way to fix it. But there is also, I'd imagine, in some cases, it's not your job as the reporter to solve the mystery, to fix the story, to address the problem. But if you are the person who has told it, does that then come with a certain degree of expectation of yourself that I must keep following up, I must keep pushing because I'm somehow responsible for bringing this story to a happy conclusion?
I often felt that. I felt the responsibility of it, that I would stay on a story for as long as possible and almost take ownership of it because you wanted to come to a conclusion. I ended up spending 5 years in the South Gauteng High Court reporting on the Jackie Salibi trial and the Glenn Agliotti, Brett Kebble case because I was adamant that I was going to stay on the story. And it consumed me for years. In a way, it defined me and defined my career because I felt that responsibility to stick with the story, to tell it in its fullness. I ended up writing a book about it. And I think that, you know, we see a lot of parachute journalism happening where we don't have the resources, unfortunately, where you get thrown into a story, you cover it, and then you move on to the next story and forget about the kind of detritus that you've left in your wake. And it's a luxury to be able to stay on a story like that.
You speak of the one book, there have been several, and we have them all at home, not my choice. My wife insists on buying them, and then I read them quietly. And they're fascinating.
You mean like David O'Sullivan, who just uses them as doorstops.
This, of course, the same man who gives people birthday cards where he's crossed out the name to David from somebody else and then recycles them effectively. A unique Mr. David O'Sullivan, good friend to us both. We both have all of the books. And when I read them, I am fascinated by the level of insight, by the amount of detail. But I go back to the comment I made at the very start of the show. How on earth are you still here? Because you are exposing so much stuff that a lot of people have gone to a great deal of trouble to conceal or to try and keep out of the public realm. Is there an element to which Mandy Wiener is a bit nervous about that? I mean, you've arrived today. I'm looking across to your security, who's somewhat menacing. You're in a space where other South Africans have been shown to be vulnerable. How do you react to that? How do you feel about that?
As much as I would like people to believe that I have security detail that is menacing, I don't, for the record, because I feel entirely safe. To be fair, I don't do as much of that kind of work anymore as I used to. I used to report a lot on the underworld. I spent a great amount of time with Radovan Krejcer and interviewing Nafis Modak and, the kind of Joburg underworld, underbelly characters. And I did report on that a lot. And I never got a direct death threat. So I never had somebody outright come and say, you know, you better stop doing this if you want to live. I always think I'd have a little bit more street cred if I got a decent death threat.
We can arrange these. Yeah. I'll make some phone calls.
I've got a couple of, upset Hell's Angels kind of members sending me messages, but nothing that I was really concerned about. However, when I had children, I'd just written a book called Ministry of Crime, which was really about the nexus between police, senior police leadership, the underworld, politicians, and I had a young child, and I thought, what on earth am I doing? Why am I doing this? So I made a conscious decision to not report on that anymore. Then I wrote a book about whistleblowers, which in a way is also pretty hairy, considering what happens to whistleblowers in South Africa, how many of them land up dead and their lives ruined by speaking truth to power. The most recent book I wrote was about politics. Now, many people would say that, in fact, criminals are now the politicians. So in a way, I've stayed
firmly in that space.
But I'm very, very mindful of my personal safety.
It's part of our country that I think worries so many of us that although there's so much to love and celebrate about South Africa, that sense of lawlessness and the often lack of accountability. And you are telling story after story, whether it is writing a book or it's on radio or you're presenting at many events you do. Most of the stories speak to some fundamental problems we have in South Africa, and the answers, the solutions don't always seem to be there. I often think of your regular carte blanche formula, where you've got 55 minutes of reasons to emigrate to Perth, and then at the end, 5 minutes of a kitten being saved from a tree, and that bulk of the bad news just seems to be on repeat. How does Mandy Wiener not get bogged down by that? How do you keep a sense of belief in South Africa, a belief that things can be better when there is so much that does seem to be challenging?
Remember, Dan, we see the very worst of South Africa, but we see the very best of it as well. My job every single day in South Africa is to tell people how bad everything is. Literally, I go on the radio every day and I speak about crime and corruption and wrongdoing and malfeasance, and we hold power to account. And it's heavy stuff. It's very negative. And you know that the media's got an inherent negativity bias. I'm more inclined to report on if you don't make it across the road safely than if you do. It's just the way that the news media works. So I'm very conscious of what we call light and shade in the media, where I feel that we've got a responsibility to balance the narratives. And this is something I speak about on stages, at conferences, in keynote addresses, all the time in South Africa, is about balancing this narrative and the lens that we use to look at the country. So there's plenty of bad stuff to talk about. I could sit here and talk to you all day about corruption and targeted assassinations. But there are also incredible stories in this country. Stories of what I like to call the hope dealers, people who are changing the narrative, active citizens, investigative journalists, people who are involved in civil society, people who are choosing to just make a difference. And there are opportunities in the crisis. There are fabulous stories of entrepreneurship and people who have seen the gap and the opportunity. So I've really tried and balance this for people that listen to me and follow me, is that I can totally be Debbie Downer. I always joke that I'm the bad things girl with my friend Brent Lindick, who is the good things guy. So, I could easily just talk about that. But I think that we're a lot more complex, a lot more nuanced. And I love the way you described us as utterly bipolar, because we really are utterly bipolar. We ride that wave in South Africa between the patriotism and amazing and the heartfelt stories, and then you hit a pothole on your way to work and,
Oh, it's completely. 1 minute we've won a Rugby World Cup and there's no better place on earth, And the next night, the traffic lights are out again and I'm moving to Auckland next month. There's very rarely a middle ground within South Africa. And that light and shade idea, I think, is a great one, because we are seduced, especially in a social media era, by the clickbait of the bad news, the air crash and not the plane that landed. And it's a job that I'm very grateful that you do, and that you're able to find some balance in. Taking that balance a little further, though, I think we all think we know Mandy Wiener through the books, through radio, through what we see of you. We've now discovered exclusively on this show that you had to forsake a professional cricket career to go into media.
You know that I genuinely believe that I could have been a professional cricket player.
I'm not doubting this for 1 minute. Possibly because you would have made any other players disappear before the game if needed, because you're very well connected. You had this love of sport. What else, when Mandy Wiener is not in the spotlight, as you so often are, what's the get your feet up, relax, live Mandy's life, as opposed to the life we see you in through the lens of the media?
So a few things. I managed to make it through multiple paddle games without tearing my Achilles.
Thank you for reminding me of the one thing I've been to therapy, both physical and mental, for the last 4 years, Mandy Wiener.
We should play paddle sometime, Dan.
I played once. I shall never, ever play again. Do you know what the real issue with that paddle was? And you set me down a rabbit hole. Oh, I did not warm up.
And you thought you were 20 and you could run around a paddle court like you were 20.
I was an hour and a half into the match. In fact, on the show, I think in the last week or two, Cooks Kushler from Supersport was playing with me. He was on the other side. I unleashed a Federer-like backhand, the majesty of which drew gasps of breath from the attendant crowd of nearly six. Single hand, none of this double-handed rubbish. Cooks was at net, thrust up his racket in a fit of self-defense. The ball hit the handle, an accidental drop shot. I leapt forward athletically, looking like a young Eastern European ballerina, to retrieve said drop shot. That's when I heard the gunshot, thought, well, it's Joburg, it's just a cash in transit heist, and ignored it, and then collapsed to the ground in agony because the Achilles had snapped completely. The real problem, though, this was 4 years ago, so I'm 43 at the time. The paramedic has arrived. I'm being put on the stretcher. They're getting the drip ready, and the paramedic asks how old I am. I'm 43, I say, through gritted teeth and streaming tears. And the young woman who's running paddle and the social media thereof, who's been Instagramming the life out of it, gasps, puts her hand to her mouth. Mr. Nicol, I'm so sorry. When I called the hospital to arrange the ambulance, they asked how old the patient was. I said, I don't know, but I think he's about 60. And that is the reason.
That's the trauma.
I am no longer playing paddle. It brings that memory back to me.
You don't look a day over 59.
Yes, well, 4 years on. It's been a tough 4 years. All right, on the paddle court.
Yeah, so I play paddle. I fall off my bicycle regularly. Uh-huh. I do like to ride my bicycle. I read a lot. I like to walk in the wilds.
Go back to the reading. Is this right? We're reading more intense socio-economic commentaries and political diatribes?
It's a mixture.
Is it a bit of Mills and Boone?
No, it's a mixture. So I read a lot of nonfiction. Mm-hmm. I interview one local nonfiction author every week on my radio show. So I have to read a lot of nonfiction, and for the work that I do as well, I write nonfiction. But I've started reading a lot of fiction as well, particularly crime, thriller. I never used to
get ideas as you expand your empire.
My criminal network, my empire. So, you know, I'm constantly looking for new ways to off people.
I suspect that it would be a fertile ground, South Africa, for international crime writers to come and discover so many stories they could draw from.
So Dion Mayer once said to me, and I love this, he said, if he had to take the plot of one of my books, a nonfiction book, and put it in one of his fiction books, nobody would believe it.
That is very, very true indeed. And he's you segue very nicely into something else I did want to speak to you about, in that you get to meet and interact with so many interesting, fascinating people. Dion is a great example. He's a lovely man, great writer. And as long as you don't ask him about motorbikes, because then he'll be on for the next 2 hours, he's just such a cool person to hang out with. You mentioned some names a little earlier, names that will turn some people's blood cold just by hearing those names. who are some of those people, not necessarily the ones that you've adored the most or that have been the most memorable interviews, but just people who, whatever they may or may not have done, and often they have done, have really fascinated you, have just proved to be such complex and interesting characters?
I do love a good crime boss. You know, I do love speaking to people who are, you know, I don't, I've interviewed a lot of politicians. So in Writing the Deal, which is the book that's just come out now, I interviewed the president, which is a very rare thing to happen in South Africa. Helen Ziller, John Steenhuisen, across the political landscape, I interviewed Gaita McKenzie, for example. But I still think that sitting down with somebody who runs an organized crime enterprise is fascinating. I just love people who tell stories. Whatever stories they may be, and the more colourful, the better. I mean, Gayton was fabulous.
Gayton does not hold back. He's very happy to tell you stories.
He drops a good F-bomb, and he told me some hilarious stories. So I love anybody who's willing to just, you know, colour in as much as possible.
And when you sit opposite somebody like, say, Radovan Krejcer, is there a sense of unease in being in the presence of these people? And I ask that because, having not met anywhere near as many as you have, but some people in that broader space, the one thing that often defines them is charm. And they speak to you very easily and very comfortably. And you almost start questioning, gee, can this person really be quite so evil?
No, I think I've come to learn that a lot of these people are, I mean, either sociopaths or whatever it may be, incredibly charming. Incredibly charming. And I cannot tell you the number of people who are associated with nefarious activities who will still come up and greet me and shake me by the hand and ask me how I am and ask how my family is and generally just come across as lovely, lovely people. And, you know, I've got a bit of flack for this, that I have glorified criminals. During the Kebble shooting, for example, I interviewed Mikey Schultz and I got a lot of criticism for that by giving him a platform. But I'm like, wouldn't you rather hear the story about what actually happened and understand the psychology and delve into this world that we would have known nothing about otherwise? So I love listening to people and hearing their stories and getting them to expose it themselves. And, you know, this investigative journalism can present in different ways. I'm absolutely shocking at following the money. I cannot do that. I cannot sit with company records and look at the numbers and work out where the money went and look at the tender. But I can sit down with people and listen to them and talk to them and network and find out other people to talk to. And I think that's a great skill as well.
The charming side of it, I think, is absolutely right. In fact, I remember a number of occasions coming around to have lunch at your house, and then there was Radovan around for lunch, or Mikey Schultz running the braai. It's great that you have this diverse selection of friends, and you've given us this great selection of stories. And I think one of the things that you've built up, as much as you will never not hold people to account, I think you've also got a very well-deserved reputation for fairness in those stories, because it is quite easy to really stick the knife in when people are clearly on the wrong side of the law. And I think you've managed to give quite a balanced portrait and perspective. And that's not just important for that specific story, it's for the next dozen stories that you want to tell.
Yeah, it's reputation. And I think that a lot of people have chosen to speak to me because I've been non-judgmental. Because I want people to have that opportunity to give their version of events. Doesn't mean I agree with it. It just means that I'm willing to listen and hear. And I think that often we're quick to judge. And I see that a lot in the media, where we're very quick to take a position. Whereas I'm interested to hear from people. And I've learned a lot about this through my work with whistleblowers and interviewing whistleblowers, and I've done a lot of training for journalists around how to report on whistleblowers, because we can very quickly cast people into roles where we immediately assume that General Mkhwanazi, for example, making a big expose, he is the hero and everyone else is a villain. And it's so important to understand the nuance and the complexities. There's so much background noise. And I think that the role of the journalist is so important in trying to decipher all of that as well.
I remember you told me exactly the same thing at Cut Mutlala's birthday party. So it is important to have that.
Great whiskey bit.
It was a terrific night out. You could tomorrow, if you wanted, decide, right, call it quits. I'm going off to just play cricket and paddle and say goodbye to the media world and everything I do. You never would, though, because it is just such an integral part of who you are. And there are always so many more stories to tell. Are there visions still dancing around the head of, well, actually, there is that story, there is that book that I still really do want to get my teeth into?
So I often think the news cycle in South Africa is kind of rinse and repeat. We go through an election cycle, we do an ANC conference, but things still surprise me. We'll still hear something outrageous at a commission and think that you can't make it. Tabo Bester will happen. And you'll think, how could this possibly be reality? So I'm very fortunate that the news cycle continues to present us with twists and turns and shocking revelations. It's very soap opera-esque in South Africa. But I'm very keen to write fiction. So that's, I think, probably the next challenge for me is to try and make this stuff up.
Oh, look, there are several people in the books you've written already who are adamant you have written fiction, but this would be more officially so. I will be fascinated. I think Dion Mayer's probably a bit nervous, but the rest of us will be very excited when these come out. Although I think you'll find your true space when it's not so much a Michael Connelly kind of piece, but more Barbara Cartland. I think that's where we'll see you. Find your natural home in due course. Even if, when that does happen, though, there'll still be this element of the reporting, the storytelling. And I'd like to ask you, because your security's glaring at me and I can hear your helicopter's just landed, two interviews, one that's been had and one that hopefully will be had. Which is the interview, the story that has given you the most personal satisfaction in this storied career? And gee, it has been an incredible career. And who is the one person you would like to sit down with in a no-holds-barred conversation?
Dan Nicol.
Oh, very difficult to get to. Charges a fortune. Absolute prima donna. And if you're on air today, I can be there with you at 12 o'clock.
Thanks very much. So I think maybe because it's the most recent, but the most satisfaction has come from interviewing the president, because I'd written an entire book in which he was one of the main characters in the negotiations for the government of national unity. And I didn't have him. And I would phone Vincent Magwenya every day, his spokesperson, and say, please, 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 just let me go for a walk with him. Let me see him. Give me anything. The book was about to go to print. We were literally about to push print. And I got a message from Vincent saying, he can see you tomorrow at the foundation, 11 o'clock. And I had to prepare and go do this interview, which he gave me an hour and a half of his time over a cup of rooibos tea and his open collared shirt. He was just telling stories. That's what I loved about it. He just regaled me with stories, whatever your political criticisms may be of him. And I had to turn that interview around in 24 hours, get it into the book and go to print. So I think that was the most satisfying. It was like, yes. Like, I got it. Like, you land that big fish. I think that's probably the one. The interview I'd most like to do? God, what a tough question. I don't know yet. It depends what happens.
Who pops up, what they do.
Yeah, who pops up.
Is there a particular person at the moment? We live in a time of right-wing strongmen.
Donald Trump,
I would be fascinated to see, well, first of all, if it went the distance, because the moment he decides he doesn't like what's being asked, he tends to
push
bring
the
it to
red
crashing
Diet Coke
hot
button and eject
and off
me
he goes.
From my seat.
But I think you would be cunning enough to work your way around it to produce something. I shall look forward to reading that one. I think in closing, when you look back, if you were to go back to 7, 8-year-old little Mandy Wiener boring all her classmates to death with suggestions that the downfall of Ceausescu was actually going to be a good thing for Romania and could kickstart a different phase for Eastern Europe, and they're just all looking at you in complete disbelief. I think if she were to be told, this is where I'm going to be now, years later, as not just one of South Africa's most respected and authoritative and often loved voices on the broader scope of current affairs, but someone who can look back on the books and the articles and the appearances and the stories. I think she would be immensely, immensely happy that this journey has played out as it has, even if it didn't involve a stint of Creed commentary.
Just ask my mother. She'll tell you. there is still something about walking into a bookshop, though. Like, I sometimes sneak into exclusive books at Hyde Park and just to...
And rearrange your books at number one.
And move Bruce Whitfield's down. And
well, name doesn't ring a bell.
I thought, and move my books in front of his. But there is something about, you know, seeing a book on a shelf with your name on it is magic. There's nothing more satisfying. Well,
do we get a sneak preview? Is there a new book in play? Have you thought about it yet?
There's this lead character, Dan Nicol, who's this James Bond-esque
in the words
international man of action.
Dion Mayer, nobody would believe a word of it. Mandy, it's been an absolute delight. Thank you. It's been great to know you over the years, and every time we've had a chance to encounter, it's normally involved some beer and some great conversation.
And I don't remember it ever involving beer.
No, that must...
Must have been somebody else.
Yeah, David O'Sullivan. thank you. Good luck with the next of the books when they come out. The Donald Trump interview, the works of fiction,
and my cricket commentary.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll get you to commentate when South Africa win a Cricket World Cup.
So. Stop it. It'll be sooner than you think.
It will indeed. And I'll look forward to joining you on your radio show when that does happen. She is not just one of South Africa's great presenters. She's one of our great authors, one of our great investigative journalists, and one of the old school types who will not let a story go until it has been fully delivered. And that is why she has got such a great, great army of fans who can't wait for the next one to come out. The current book is there. If you can't find it immediately, just look behind Bruce Whitfield's books, because he does the same thing when he drops in at exclusive. And as always with Mandy Wiener, it is a great read. My very special guest on the show this week, it's Mandy Wiener.
You're listening to The Dan Nicol Show.